I've already talked about slide three. We were talking about this table of elements. And this is listed for the human body, but it's largely true for any given organism. Any organism is made up of oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen, because those are because two of the four biological macromolecules that all organisms are made of contain nitrogen, and all four of those kinds of macromolecules contain the other three. So that's why those are really chief among the atom types in terms of abundance in the body of any given organism. There are others that are absolutely vital for various reasons, but you just need trace amounts of those. Notice, though, that all of these elements listed are elements that are near the top of the periodic table. The periodic table lists all elements, but most of the ones that are on the bottom here, you don't want any part of. Those should not be in your body. Organisms are mostly made out of the ones at the top, which are the smallest atoms. They're the lightest elements. We'll have much more to say about elements, though, in a little bit. Let's go on to four now and talk about atoms. Atoms are building blocks of matter, meaning that all material objects in the universe are made out of atoms. But you can't really say that an atom is a fundamental particle, because even though everything's built out of atoms, atoms themselves are built out of even smaller things called subatomic particles. Subatomic simply meaning even smaller than the atom. And I say even smaller because an atom, the size of an atom is almost inconceivably tiny, which is why you require so many atoms in terms of moles, that huge number I was talking about, before it even becomes a humanly visible collection. A single cell contains millions, many millions of atoms, and one cell is invisibly small to our eye. So you have trillions of cells, each of which contains many millions of atoms. That's how small atoms are. But any material, as I said, is made out of atoms. Atoms themselves, or a single atom, contains two or three, usually three, subatomic particle types. In other words, there are three categories of primary subatomic particles. Now, we're not going to get into the fact that you can even break down those subatomic particles into smaller things, but because that's not biology, that's the realm of physics. So we're not going to go past these three primary subatomic particles, but they are electrons, protons, and neutrons. You've likely heard of these before. Well, I'll have more to say about the particles themselves in a minute, but first let me say that an atom's arrangement of these subatomic particles is such that there is a central nucleus, and just realize that the atomic nucleus, or an atomic nucleus, that's a totally different use of the word nucleus than we've been using up to now. We've been talking about cell nuclei, the basis for the difference between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cell. Well, here we're talking about the nucleus of the atom. And nucleus simply means core, so it's the central part. But it's a region in the space that an atom occupies at the center. And what defines the nucleus, the atomic nucleus, is that's where that atom's protons are, however many protons it has. By definition, an atom has to have at least one proton. But however many there are, they're all in the nucleus. The nucleus is where the protons are. Now, you see brown particles in this cartoon as well, which are neutrons. Neutrons might or might not be there. It depends on the atom. But however many neutrons an atom has, zero or more, those are also found in the nucleus. Therefore, the nucleus contains protons and neutrons. But That's all it contains in terms of these three primary subatomic particles. The third type of particle, which is the electron, is never found in the nucleus, only protons and neutrons. Electrons are found somewhere outside of the nucleus, meaning, I say somewhere here because it's impossible actually to know with certainty at any given moment exactly where an electron is. And why we have this uncertainty is also beyond the scope of this course. But just believe me that it's impossible to actually tell exactly where an electron is. But we can mathematically determine what's called a probability space, which means we know plate regions in space where it's more likely for it to be than not. And so this picture here is really a lie. This cartoon is a simple lie, but it's what I mean by that is that, well, it's a lie for a couple reasons. One is that electrons do not circle around the nucleus. They are found somewhere outside of the nucleus, but they don't travel in circular orbits like this picture implies. Also, it's a lie because the scale is way off. This picture shows electrons and protons being the same size, which is almost true. Protons and neutrons are almost exactly the same mass, not quite. Remember, mass is how much stuff is in a sample, including subatomic particles. Electrons, on the other hand, are much, much smaller than protons and neutrons. A lot smaller than this picture implies. So if they showed it to true scale, you wouldn't really see the electrons from where you are. So it's a lie for that reason as well. But the major points are true here, one of which I still haven't talked about. Protons are found only in the nucleus. They're about the same mass as neutrons. But protons are charged particles, whereas neutrons are not charged. By charge, I'm talking about an electrical charge. Protons are positively charged. Each individual proton carries a charge equal to positive 1. And so that's why the magenta protons are equipped with pluses in this cartoon. Neutrons are so named because they are not electrically charged. They're electrically neutral. So they're neutral particles or neutrons. All right? Electrons are charged. So of the three particle types, two of them are charged particles. But electrons are negatively charged. You see that with the negative symbols in the cartoon. Now, I just talked about the size disparity between protons and electrons. Protons are much bigger than electrons. Despite this huge size disparity between these particles, though, the magnitude or the size of the charge for a proton, that positive 1, is exactly equal to the size of the charge in an electron, but in the opposite direction. So each individual electron carries a full negative 1 charge, and each proton carries one full positive 1 charge. All right? Despite the fact that electrons are much tinier. So we usually, when we use the word atom, are referring to a neutral atom. We don't bother saying neutral atom. Atom implies that it's neutral. By which I mean overall electrically neutral. And that's because in a neutral atom, the number of protons is the same as the number of electrons. And since I just told you that their charges are equal in size but in opposite directions, when you add up all those positive ones and negative ones, however many there are, they'll come out to zero if the number of protons equals the number of electrons. Just as in this cartoon. Right, there are two protons and there are two electrons. Those add up to zero overall because a tiny electron's negative charge completely counteracts the positive charge of a much bigger proton. And the neutrons aren't contributing anything to the overall charge of the atom because they are, by definition, neutral. Okay, now slide five shows you the same picture again in B. A is still a lie, but it's less of a lie. Because now it's A is better because it's depicting what I already told you, namely the fact that we don't know exactly where electrons are. We can compute where it's more likely for them to be than not, and that's depicted here by the yellowness of this electron cloud. So there are electrons here. We don't know exactly where, but the darker the yellow is, the more likely they are to be there. They are not going to be in the nucleus. They're going to be somewhere around the nucleus. Okay, let's go on to six. Now we need to talk about several different spaces in an atom. And spaces are not material, right? They are just regions in space. The first of these are what are called electron shells. That's one name for them. They can also be called energy levels. Energy level and electron shell are interchangeable terms. They mean exactly the same thing. And what you see on the bottom part of this figure is that any given electron, which is somewhere outside of the nucleus, occupies a space called a shell or an energy level. And a given atom contains multiple shells. But remember that shells are not material. When I say contains shells, I mean features spaces that could be occupied by electrons. And those spaces are called shells. All right? The important point shown in this slide is that there are multiple shells that or energy levels that get farther and farther away from the atomic nucleus where the protons and neutrons are. And electrons can occupy any shell, but as is indicated by the ball bouncing down the stairs, an electron can never be between shells, these spaces. So an electron is either in a shell or in a different shell, never halfway between, just like you can run this ball bouncing experiment as many times as you want, and it's never going to land some fraction of a step down from the top, right? It might stay at the top, it might land on any step, or might go all the way down, but it's fully in one level or another, the levels being indicated by being represented by the stairs themselves. Similarly with energy levels. So electrons can move between energy levels, but they're going to pop up a complete level or more, or pop down a complete level or more, never be fractionally in between. Oh, by the way, the arrows indicate the energy, and this is why these shells are also called energy levels. Electrons are attracted, because they're negative, to the positive nucleus, positive by virtue of the existence of protons there, and this attraction exists because opposite electrical charges attract each other. So it's a lower energy state for an electron to be at a lower shell, a lower energy level. It can move to a higher energy level, but that takes energy that has to be absorbed by the atom in order to move it up an energy level. And if there's room in the lower energy level, then the electron will fall back down because it wants to attain the lowest energy state. Whether there's room in that shell, though, is an important thing that we're going to talk more about. Okay, so that is one subspace of the atom. Shells or energy levels. Now those are, like I said, not materials. They are just spaces. But even though they're not made out of anything, the spaces can be subdivided into spaces within them, subspaces within a shell. All right? And we call those subspaces within shells subshells. Okay? That's still not made out of anything, but it's part of a shell. Just like a subset is part of a set. And then subshells, which are themselves spaces, can be subdivided into even smaller spaces called orbitals or electron orbitals. But usually we just say orbitals. Still, we're not talking about any material. We're talking just about spaces within spaces within spaces. An orbital is a space within a bigger space called a subshell, which itself is a space within a bigger space called an energy level or a shell. Everyone clear on all that? Now, this picture in slide 7 represents the shapes of orbitals. And can you tell how many orbitals there are here? No, there are two kinds of orbitals, but there are 5 orbitals here. See this darker circle? That's an orbital. The bigger circle is an orbital, or sphere, really, because it's in 3 dimensions. And each of these dumbbell or infinity symbol-shaped things is one orbital, and there's 3 of those. See that? So there's 5 overall. You see that it's 5 now? Okay, now these are just spaces. There's a really important thing to know about orbitals. Any given orbital, and there are different kinds, but regardless of the type, any individual orbital can contain at most 2 electrons, which means there's 3 possibilities for an individual orbital. It contains 2 electrons, the max. Contains 2 electrons, max, the max. It contains 1 electron, or it contains 0 electrons. That's the only 3 possibilities, right? It's empty, it has 1, or it's full with 2 electrons. That's for any individual orbital. But there are different kinds of orbitals. And how many kinds are there and how many of each there are depends on the shell. So the closest shell to the nucleus, which is the first energy level or the first shell, that really contains only 1 subshell, which is just as big as the shell itself. They're just different names for the same thing. Kind of like if you have the set of numbers, just one member of the set. Just say the number 1 is the set. Well, you could say that the set containing the number 1 is also a subset of that set, even though it's the whole thing, right? And that's kind of like what's happening with the subshell for the first shell. The reason that we refer to subshells is that a subshell within a shell is made up of all but only that kind of orbital. Okay, so, and there are three different kinds of orbitals that we're going to care about in this course. Actually, only 2 that we care about. There's more than 2. But you might learn about them in chemistry. There are so-called S orbitals, and they are spherical in shape. So we can see two different S orbitals here, the smaller sphere and the bigger sphere. There are P orbitals as well, and those are the dumbbell-shaped ones, which you can see 3 of here. And then there are D orbitals, F orbitals. Those are ones that only come into play when you get farther down the periodic table, which is not so much a biology concern. But anyway, a subshell is simply a collection of all the same kind of orbitals in that shell. Now, the first shell, I said, contains only one subshell, and we call it the S subshell because it contains all of the S orbitals in that shell. For any shell, any level, there is an S subshell because every shell, including shell 1, contains S orbitals. But it's also true that every shell contains exactly one S orbital. Okay, so really the space that we call energy level 1 and the space that we call the S subshell and the space we call the S orbital, those are all the same thing for the first shell. Because the first shell contains only one kind of orbital. It contains only one of them. It's an S orbital. And therefore, the orbital, the subshell, and the shell itself, the energy level, are all really the same space. Okay? Did I lose anyone there? There are no P orbitals in the first shell. If we go up a level to the second shell, the second shell, like all shells, has its own S orbital. But it's a bigger sphere. That's this bigger circle. Okay? And also, it's like all levels, that single S orbital is the only S orbital in that shell. Therefore, the S orbital, that single S orbital for that shell, makes up the entire S subshell for that shell. But starting with shell 2, in addition to having an S subshell with an S orbital in it, there's also a P subshell containing all the P orbitals in that shell. And for all levels that contain P orbitals, which is 2 and above, levels 2 and above, that single level contains exactly 3 P orbitals. We're seeing the 3 P orbitals that make up the P subshell in energy level 2. Okay? So there's 2 complete shells shown here, 1 and 2. One is made up of one subshell called the S subshell. That subshell contains exactly one S orbital, and we call it, by symbol, the 1S orbital, with the 1 coming before the S denoting the shell that it's in, the energy level. All right? Like I said, those 3 spaces are really different names for the same thing. The 1S orbital, the first shell's S subshell, and the first shell itself are all really the same thing. Then we go up to energy level 2. And that has its own S subshell made up of a single S orbital. But that's the 2S orbital because we're in the second shell. And since we're in the second shell, in addition to having an S subshell, there's also a P subshell, which contains all of the P-type orbitals in that shell, which there are 3 of. Okay? 1, 2, and 3. And this is a flat image, but the 3 P orbitals are arranged mutually orthogonally, which simply means that each one is at right angles to the other 2. So the axis that goes, the long axis through the dumbbell, is perpendicular to both of the other 2. It's like the X, Y, and Z axes. Each one is perpendicular to the other 2. All right? But those would all be 2P orbitals as well. There's 3 of them, though, so we usually distinguish them by saying 2PX, 2PY, 2PZ. X, Y, and Z correspond to the three axes of a three-dimensional space. Cartesian coordinates for a three-dimensional graph, for instance. Okay, that is a simple picture. We're really this pretty much the same thing is shown in 8, but now you can get, since this information is separated, you can get a better idea of what I said in words. The first shell contains only one subshell called the S shell, or S subshell, and that S subshell contains only one S orbital, which is called the 1s orbital because it's in the first shell. The second shell has two subshells in it, an S subshell containing all the S orbitals, which there's only one of, and a P subshell containing all the P orbitals that are in it, which there are three of. So the second shell contains how many orbitals? No, it contains two subshells. Three is also wrong. Four is correct. There's four orbitals because there's a 2s, that's one orbital, and there's three 2p orbitals, right? A total of four orbitals. And what did I tell you a little earlier about any individual orbital, regardless of its type? It can contain at most two electrons. It can't contain any more than two. And therefore, how many electrons completely fill the first shell? No. Two, because the first shell contains only one subshell, which contains only one orbital. There's only one orbital in the entire first shell. That's the 1s orbital. So either there are no electrons there, there's one electron there, or there's two. But if there are two, then that whole shell is filled. Is that clear? What about shell two? Four what? You're giving me just numbers. Two what? Two houses? No. There are never 2s orbitals within the same shell. Each shell contains its own s, but there's only one of them in that shell. See, this one, this is the 2s orbital. That's the only s orbital in the second shell. There are three different p orbitals in that same shell. The single S that's in the second shell makes up shell 2's S subshell, because a subshell contains only orbitals of the same type. The three P orbitals in the second subshell collectively make up the second shell's P subshell. Right? Because they are all P types. They belong to the same subshell for that reason alone. But there are three individual P's. Therefore, the second shell, as we said, contains four total orbitals. And therefore, it takes how many electrons to fill the second shell? Eight. This is the essence, this is the reason behind the so-called octet rule in chemistry. And how many filled the first shell?
Two.
All right, let's look at the periodic table of the elements, which is arranged according to atom type. But it's important to understand what makes an atom a certain element as opposed to some other element. And we've been talking about three different subatomic particles, but only one of those matters with respect to what kind of element you have for a given atom. All right? There's only one thing that makes any individual atom an atom of that element, whatever the element is. And that one thing that matters is the number of protons that that atom has. The number of neutrons and the number of electrons have nothing to do with whether it is a certain element or another element. So, for example, the simplest element is hydrogen, and every atom of hydrogen is an atom of hydrogen only if and only because It has exactly one proton. It is element number one. That one is called the atomic number. The atomic number for any given atom is simply the number of protons that are in the nucleus of that atom. And that alone determines that it's an element, that it's that kind of element. All right? If you had any other number of protons, including zero, then you wouldn't have hydrogen. If it's zero, you wouldn't have an atom. If it's higher number, then you would have all the one of the other ones. Each one has its own atomic number. Now, the periodic table is arranged as a table. Obviously, tables have rows and columns, but we don't use those words in chemistry. What do we call the rows of the periodic table instead of rows? Periods. They're called periods. Periods are repeating structures. And that's why it's called the periodic table of the elements, because each row repeats certain things about the members of that period or row. What do we call the columns? Groups, exactly. And so hydrogen is in the first period and the first group. But back to this fact that the first shell has only one orbital in the entire shell and therefore can be filled up by two electrons. It can't hold any more. That's why the first period contains only two atoms, hydrogen and helium. Each individual period in the periodic table corresponds to a shell. So this first period is shell one. It contains only two atoms because as soon as you get to helium, which by definition is helium because it has two protons, well, it's a neutral atom only if it has the same number of electrons, so having two protons means it would have to have two electrons as well to be neutral. And as soon as you have two electrons, that's all that shell can hold. That's why it's the only other member of period one. Does that make sense? Because this is the first shell. Two electrons in there, that's the max. Now, if you have three protons instead of two, then by definition you're a lithium atom. The proton number alone is what makes you lithium. But if you're a neutral lithium atom, then you also have three electrons to correspond to your three positive protons. Two of those are going to completely fill the first shell, just like they did for helium. But there's a third one, and therefore the third one has to, the lowest it can be, which it wants to be at a low level as possible, is the second shell. And there's how many slots in the second shell for electrons? Eight. Eight slots in four orbitals. Three P's and one S. Okay? So there's plenty of room for that third electron. But notice that there's eight elements in that second period corresponding to the fact that that second shell has the capacity to contain up to eight electrons since it has four orbitals. Is that all clear? Tell me if it's not.
Wait, so the second period is supposed to be like, has two shells, right?
No, the second, each period is a shell. Now, the shell itself, energy level 2, contains two subshells. It contains an S subshell for the second level and a P subshell for the second level. Then we break those spaces down into orbitals. The S subshell of shell 2 contains just a single S orbital called the 2S orbital. And the P subshell of shell 2 contains only P orbitals, but there are three of those. So four overall orbitals, each of which can contain up to 2 electrons, for a total of 8 possible electrons for just the second shell.
I think I got that part down, but what did you say the periods represent?
Shells, or energy levels. So the first energy level is going to be maxed out in terms of electron containment with only 2 electrons, since there's only 1 total orbital in that entire shell.
Okay.
That's why there's hydrogen and helium and nothing else. Can't fit any more electrons than the 2 electrons that helium has.
But on like the second one, you have like F is 9, wouldn't have to be F.
No, F is 9. That's the atomic number. It has 9 electrons.
Yeah.
2 of them are in the first shell, though.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then that leaves 7 more.
First shell. Okay.
But if you just count the number that are in the entire period, that's 8.
When we get to the fourth period, would you have 3 shells since you can clean up or
more? The fourth period is a shell.
Yeah.
Each period is just 1 shell. You mean subshells?
Okay, so that would be the fourth shell, right? This
is the third shell. This is the fourth shell. These numbers are shells.
Yes.
But you have subshells within each one, and yes, starting with the third, actually, you have
three
subshells.
Three subshells.
Right there, starting with the third, you have an S subshell containing 1 S orbital.
Yes.
You have a P subshell containing 3 P orbitals, and you have a D subshell containing 5 D orbitals that we haven't talked about.
Okay.
And we're not going to talk about D's and beyond, but that's how it works. Yeah. The higher the energy level, the more types of orbitals there are, and the more orbitals overall, because starting with level 3, there's these D orbitals. Well, any 3 and above, each level contains 5 D orbitals, making up that D subshell. The second shell doesn't have a D subshell because it doesn't have any D orbitals. And the first shell doesn't contain any a P subshell because it doesn't have any P orbitals. Okay. Now let's go to 9. This is an abbreviated version of the periodic table. This is really just the stuff near the top. That's what I said organisms are made out of mostly. There are occasional larger atoms that make their way into organisms, but these are the biggies. What's different about this compared to the periodic table that's on the wall is that we see cartoon representations of atomic nuclei and spaces around the atomic nuclei containing some number of electrons. The yellow dots represent electrons. All right. The white sphere is the atomic nucleus. So you don't see any detail in there, but you know by definition of being hydrogen that there's 1 proton in there. By definition of being helium, there's 2 protons in that nucleus that just aren't shown. The important thing here are the electrons in terms of what's happening in this, being portrayed in this slide. And we can see what I've already said in words. The first shell contains only 2 elements because as soon as you get to a 2 electron containing atom, that whole shell is full already because it contains only 1 orbital. Therefore, lithium to neon, in addition to having the first shell filled with their first 2 electrons, also are filling the second shell. So these concentric yellow circles represent shells, not orbitals. How do you know, just from glancing, that they can't represent orbitals? Yeah?
Because they're green, right?
Well, beyond the shape. The shape is true that, like, P orbitals aren't that shape. That's one thing. But how else can you tell that a yellow ring can't possibly be an orbital? Right, because some of them contain more than 2, right? That's impossible for an orbital. So these yellow rings represent energy levels or shells. There's only 1 in the first period, that's the first shell. There's 2 in the second period, that's the second shell, and so on. But since the second shell has a single S and 3 different P's, it has 4 orbitals overall, and therefore can hold up to 8. That's why neon, with its 10 overall electrons, fills both of the first shells. Its first 2 electrons fill up entirely the first shell, which can hold only 2, and then the other 8 of its 10 completely fill the second shell. Now that's important because a completely full shell gives particular stability to an atom. And that's true for all these elements that are in the final group, the rightmost group. Helium, neon, argon, krypton, and so on. Those collectively, that group, is called the noble gases, which are very stable just by themselves as individual atoms. And that's because of a full subshell, outer subshell. Okay? Now, the noble gases, because of that stability, because they're already full, do not want to interact with any other atoms, including atoms of their same type. So they just exist as monatomic elements that don't react under normal circumstances with anything. Okay, neon just stays as neon, and so on for the others. But that right edge of the periodic table represents very high stability. And as we'll see, all the other elements undergo chemical reactions in such a way as to be like one of those noble gases in terms of stability. Everything other than the noble gases, though, are unstable by comparison. And that's why they undergo chemical reactions. All right? More about that in a minute. Less than a minute, actually, because in this slide is how we'll start this. Slide 10 represents the creation of ions. Now, remember I said a little bit ago that when we use the word atom, what we really are implying by that is that it's a neutral atom. The kind of atom it is determined only by the proton number. But if it's neutral, whatever the proton number of protons is, it has to have that same number of electrons. Okay? So we only use the word atom to describe such particles, ones that have the same number of electrons and protons. Ion is a word that also refers to an atom, really, except we call it an atom because it doesn't have the same number of electrons as protons. Now, notice that you could get to the condition in which the number of electrons no longer equals the number of protons in 2 different ways, right? 4 different ways, really. You could add protons, subtract protons, add electrons, or subtract electrons. Any one of those would result in the number of electrons no longer equaling the number of protons, right? But if you add or subtract protons, that is not a chemical reaction. What you're doing there is changing the kind of element you have. And ordinary chemical reactions do not change the number of protons in any of the atoms involved. So, to form ions, there's really only 2 ways that can happen. The number of protons stays the same. The element stays the same, by virtue of the fact that the proton number determines that element. And the 2 ways, therefore, to turn that atom, which is neutral, into an ion is to either add electrons or some number, 1 or more, or subtract electrons, 1 or more. Notice that whether electrons are added or subtracted, it's going to result in the situation in which that number of electrons, whatever it is, no longer equals the number of protons. And that, by definition, makes that atom no longer eligible to be called a neutral atom, and instead we use the word ion. Now, this slide, as to use as an example of ions forming, is portraying the same chemical reaction that we talked about in the opening slide. The one that turns deadly sodium and deadly chlorine into required sodium chloride, right? That is the chemical reaction. That's why there is an arrow here. But really what we're focusing on here is not really the reaction, but the fact that ions are forming. Now, sodium, when you look at where it is on the periodic table, is in group 1. Any of the elements that's in group 1 has one more electron. We're assuming these are neutral to begin with, right? Any of these has one more electron than the previous shell can hold. Right? Sodium is one step after neon. Neon's nice and happy because it's 10 electrons, perfectly fill up shells 1 and 2. 2 in the first, 8 in the second. Well, a neutral sodium atom has one more electron because by definition it has one more proton. You can't fit that in that shell anymore. So that means you need a new shell to work with. And we don't even consider shells, by the way, unless there's at least one electron in it. So sodium features 3 shells that have atoms, have electrons in them. That third one shell, though, has only one electron in it. And so things that are on the left side of the periodic table, not necessarily that left edge, but the groups that are to the left, for the same reason, just different numbers, are atoms whose outer shell is more empty than full. Right? Sodium's third shell is almost empty. It only has one electron in it. And the next one, next door, magnesium, has only 2. It can hold a lot more. This corresponds to a dichotomy, well, not truly a dichotomy, but to 2 of the categories of substance types. Most of the elements in the periodic table are metals. The ones that are in the upper right-hand corner, they're on most periodic tables, there's kind of a stair step drawn right here. Anything above and to the right of that stair step, these things are nonmetals. Everything else, besides ones that are right on the stairs, are metals. So you can see that most elements are metals. Okay? And metals, being on the left, are atoms that have an outer shell that is more empty than full. Nonmetals, on the other hand, are just the opposite, as you'd expect for something called nonmetals. They're close to the right edge. They're almost as happy as the noble gases are with respect to the fullness of their outer shells. So they have, those nonmetals feature atoms whose outer shells are more full than empty. Okay, now back to this example. Sodium is a metal. Chlorine is a nonmetal. 17 is chlorine, right? Notice that chlorine is one step away from perfectly happy argon. And that's because if it has just one more electron in its outer shell, it will be totally full, and it'll be just as stable as argon. But it's one step away. Sodium is one step away from neon, a lot of steps away from argon. right? It just passed argon. I mean, just passed neon. But you can't fit that electron in that shell anymore. So, metals, since they are have an outer shell that is mostly empty, or more empty than full, form ions not by gaining electrons, because it takes quite a few electrons to fill up that shell, since it's mostly empty. Rather, metals form ions by losing electrons. Nonmetals, on the other hand, being almost full in their outer shell, form ions by taking on additional electrons. That's easier. It's easier to take on a small number of electrons than it is to get rid of a larger number of electrons. And for metals, it's easier to lose a small number of electrons than it is to take on a large number of additional electrons. And this is exactly why sodium and chlorine react to form two different ions. Each one of these atoms, neutral to begin with, is going to form an ion. But you can see now, using these representations of shells, that sodium will be nice and happy if it just loses the only electron that's in this shell, in which case we don't even consider it a shell anymore, right? If it loses this red electron, then the only shells it has are 1 and 2, and 2 is already filled, just like neon. You see what I'm saying there? Okay. Chlorine is almost full in its third shell. It's one step away from argon. So in the presence of sodium, it will gladly take the electron that sodium is trying to get rid of, because it will completely fill its third, and that will make it just nice and happy as well. Chlorine is the nonmetal here. It's forming an ion by taking an additional electron on. Sodium is the metal. It's forming an ion like metals do by getting rid of an electron or more. Okay? When that happens, you no longer have a sodium atom or a chlorine atom. You no longer have sodium as a substance and chlorine as a substance. Instead, you have two ions, a sodium ion and a chloride ion. For the nonmetals, we change the name. It's no longer chlorine, it's chloride ion. And those two ions are oppositely charged. When a metal, by virtue of having an outer shell that's more empty than full, loses its outer electrons to become an ion, that's going to make it what kind of atom in terms of charge? I mean, what kind of ion? It's going to be what charge, positive or negative is what I mean. It's going to not be negative. It's going to be positive. A metal loses electrons. The sodium is losing an electron. Why would that make it negative? You're losing negativeness by losing the negative that electrons carry, right? The number of positives, which are in the nucleus, the protons, stays the same. So by losing an electron, that atom no longer has as many negative charges as it has positive charges. And therefore, when you add them up, it's not going to add to zero. You're going to have more positive than negative. It's going to be a positive number. So that's the how it works for metals in general. Metals form ions by losing electrons, and that makes the ion, therefore, that results negatively charged. Any charged particle is an ion, but we have two non-overlapping subgroups. Any given ion is either an anion or a cation. An and cat are opposites. For instance, anode and cathode in electricity. Or in biology, we also use these opposites, like an anadromous fish is one that swims downstream to spawn, whereas a catadromous fish swims upstream. They're opposite in direction. Well, an anion is a negatively charged ion. A cation is a positively charged particle. And since metals lose electrons to become positively charged, that means metals form cations. Nonmetals take on electrons to become negative, and therefore they, when they become ions, they become anions specifically. Notice that's happening here. The chloride is an anion. The sodium is a cation. They're oppositely charged, and therefore there is an electrostatic attraction between them, an electrostatic force of attraction. So that holds these two oppositely charged ions together, the fact that they're attracted to each other. And that is an example, the first example of ones that we're going to look at, of a chemical bond. Now, not all bonds are chemical bonds, but an ionic bond is a chemical bond. What makes any given bond a chemical bond is that if that bond forms, you have new stuff, which is what's happening in a chemical reaction, right? You no longer have sodium, you no longer have chlorine, instead you have sodium chloride, new substance. And that's because an ionic bond is a chemical bond. Now, the only thing that holds these things together is the force of attraction because of their opposite charge. And that's not the weakest force of attraction, as we'll see, but it is much weaker than the next kind of bond we'll talk about, which are covalent bonds. Ionic bonds are chemical bonds. They form new stuff if they form, but they're much easier to break than covalent bonds. Before we get to covalent bonds, let's go to slide 11. And what's important about this, in the previous slide, we just looked at the formation of ionic bond in terms of two individual neutral atoms. Notice that though there was a transfer, a more or less permanent transfer of an electron from the metal, which has too many electrons, to the non-metal, which has not enough electrons to be happy. All right? And so once that transfer is made, the two ions are formed, that electron is going to stay with the anion. It has permanently left the cation. That's an ionic bond. But there's almost never the situation that only a single metal atom and only a single non-metal atom are involved. Usually there are trillions and trillions of them, even in the smallest sample, right? Because atoms are so small. Well, when a metal, like sodium, becomes a cation, a positively charged ion, it's not positive in a certain direction. The whole thing is positive. So if you approach it from any side of it, it looks positive. And similarly, or conversely, an anion, by virtue of receiving that additional electron, is negative from all directions. So when you have trillions and trillions of sodium ions and chloride ions, because of these transfers between individual atoms, then the whole thing, the whole collection of two types of ions clumps together in a crystal lattice, as we see here. What I mean is that this individual sodium ion, the yellow one, is not attracted to just this single chloride ion. It's attracted to chloride ions in all directions from itself. And similarly, each green one is attracted to all the yellow ones in all directions, not just one. Therefore, sodium chloride, which is an example of a salt, is another word for ionic compounds that are made from the formation of ionic bonds. Okay, those are salts. I also use the word compound here. Compound is important. Compounds are combinations of elements. Like I said, there's only roughly 100 elements in the universe. There's no limit to the number of compounds because you can use those any number of elements combined together to form compounds. But while it's true to say that there is an atom of each element's type, it doesn't make sense to say that there is an atom of water, for instance. Water is a compound, right? By definition, a compound is made up of at least two different kinds of atoms, two elements. Okay, but when ionic bonds form to produce an ionic compound or a salt, there is no prescribed size of that compound in terms of the number of ions involved. All right? Ionic compounds are not made out of molecules. Molecules can make up compounds and do make up a lot of compounds, but not ionic compounds. Molecules has a special meaning that I'll talk about in a minute. But the point here is that there is no such thing as a molecule of sodium chloride because the chunk can be as big or as little as it needs to be or as you want it to be based on how many individual ions are present. Notice, though, that there is no upper limit. For instance, mining salt, which is how you get sodium chloride to buy from the grocery store, there are chunks that are bigger than buildings. That it's all one piece. It's not made up of individual chunks like water is. We call those molecules. That's not what's happening here. It's all one big piece because of how they're all attracting each other. But notice there is a lower limit. The smallest possible piece of sodium chloride would be what's represented in the previous slide, namely one sodium ion and one chloride ion. If you get below that, you no longer have salt, right? You have to have at least one of each for that particular compound. And so we don't say that ionic compounds are made up of molecules. Instead, we say the smallest possible bit of an ionic compound is what's called a formula unit. All right? Now, before I get to 12, let me say something that I was reminding myself to tell, but I kept talking and interfering with myself. I keep saying outer subshell or outer shell, which mean different things, but they both apply here. This brings up, though, what I wanted to say earlier, the notion of valence, or the word valence, I should say, not the notion. This is something you need to be careful with because it's used three different ways. All right, now, one use of it is to talk about a valence shell or a valence subshell. In this use, the word valence refers to just the outermost shell or subshell that contains at least one electron. Like I said, if they're totally empty, we don't even consider them to be there. So for hydrogen and helium, the valence shell is shell 1. That's the outermost shell that contains electrons. But lithium has shell 2 as its valence shell. All right? And so on. That's one use of the word. We can also talk about any given atom's number of valence electrons. The number of valence electrons is simply the number of electrons that are occupying that atom's valence shell. Is that clear? So what's the number of valence electrons, for instance, for nitrogen? Which is element number 7, if you can't see this. The number of valence electrons? It is 5. It has 7 overall electrons because what makes it nitrogen is that it has 7 protons, but it's neutral, so it has 7 electrons as well, right? 2 of those occupy the first shell, which by definition in this atom are not valence electrons because they're not in the outermost shell that contains electrons. The other 5, though, are in the outer or valence shell. So nitrogen has 5 valence electrons. But here's where you need to be careful, because that's using the word valence in the phrase number of valence electrons. We also use the word valence by itself to refer to how many additional electrons it would require for that type of atom to have its valence shell filled. So using nitrogen again, what is the valence of nitrogen? Yes. Nitrogen has a valence of 3. It has 5 valence electrons. 5 plus 3 add up to 8, which is what will fill that valence shell. Okay? Is that clear? What about hydrogen? What's its number of valence electrons? 1. Hydrogen has only 1 electron, right? That 1 electron is in the outermost shell. It's the only shell that has electrons. So it has 1 valence electron. What is the valence of hydrogen? 1. Because that first shell, unlike the other ones, fills up with just 2, right? So it has 1, but it needs 1 more. Those just happen to equal each other in that case. Similarly for carbon. Carbon has 4 valence electrons. It also has a valence of 4 because 4 additional beyond the 4 that it has that are valence electrons will bring it to 8, which fills that shell. Okay, now, you can think of the valence also as how many steps away from the right edge an atom is. Just like hydrogen is 1 step from the right edge, nitrogen is 3 steps from the right edge. That tells you how many additional electrons it has to have to make it nice and full like a noble gas atom. Yes, within a period. The first period only has those 2, so even though it's far in distance on the table from the right edge, it's only 1 step from helium.
Okay.
And by the way, I didn't mention this before, but hydrogen, even though it's on the left side, is a non-metal. All the other ones that, all the black ones pretty much, even though blackness has nothing to do with that, are metals, except until you get to that stair step diagonal I was drawing. But hydrogen is kind of a special case. It is a non-metal, though. Just like boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and fluorine, so on. Okay, now, this idea of valence is exactly why chemical reactions occur the way they do. Each individual atom that is involved in a chemical reaction is going to rearrange its electrons in such a way that it will attain greater stability, like the right edge of the periodic table. Now, ions do that by actually transferring electrons from one to the other permanently. That's kind of a lie, too, but it's good enough for this course. All right? That's an ionic compound that's formed, like sodium chloride. Ionic compounds involve a reaction between a metal and a nonmetal. So most of the elements, which are metals, can react with those few that are nonmetals and to form salts, transferring permanently electrons from the metal to the nonmetal, forming oppositely charged ions, holding them together. But this next category of chemical bond, which is the covalent bond, is formed in reactions involving a nonmetal and another nonmetal. Covalent bonds form between nonmetals. And a covalent bond, like an ionic bond, is a chemical bond because if it forms, then you have suddenly new stuff. That's why it's called a chemical bond. You have new stuff when a chemical reaction occurs, right? It is also a rearrangement of electrons. That's what chemical reactions are, rearrangements of electrons. And by the way, that should make sense to you based on the architecture of atoms, right? When two atoms come into contact with each other, which they have to react, it's not the protons or the nuclei that are coming into contact, right? What actually meet are the electron clouds. And so that's what gets rearranged in chemical reactions, electrons. But they get rearranged based on valences, which give those individual atoms higher stability if they get toward that right edge. Now, the example shown here for a covalent bond is forming between two hydrogen atoms, which I just told you are nonmetals. So this goes with what I just said. Covalent bonds form between nonmetals. And here you have to appreciate valence. Each individual hydrogen atom has a valence of one, right? Which means it needs one more electron to be as happy as helium. They're both in exactly the same situation. So neither of them wants to take fully an electron from the other. Oh, I mean, actually, they do want that, but neither wants to give up an electron, is what I should say, right? Both of them want to gain one more electron, but in the chemical reaction, there's no addition or subtraction of particles. It's just a rearrangement. So they can't both take an electron. There's no metal that will gladly give them an electron. Instead, they strike a deal to share with each other the one electron that each of them has. And that sharing arrangement, even though there are only two electrons total in this situation, is such that each individual hydrogen, represented by its nucleus, that's what defines the atom itself, is getting credit for both of those shared electrons, even though there's only two overall. Each of them actually is stable as though they fully had both of those electrons to themselves. And that's because the electrons are not transferred one way, but shared. That's what the co of covalent means. Just like co-stars share the lead, right? So the electrons, which, like I said, are somewhere around a nucleus, if they are shared electrons, they will be somewhere around either of the two nuclei. And sometime, at any given moment, they might be closer to one nucleus than the other, but both nuclei get credit for both of them. And very importantly, a single covalent bond, which is what's shown here, forming, consists of a pair, two electrons, because each involved atom has to contribute one to the sharing, otherwise it's not a fair deal, right? So it's a single bond that's forming, but it consists of two electrons, one from each of the two constituent atoms. And that's what holds them together, not electrostatic attraction, but the fact that the electrons are spending time around both nuclei. That is a much stronger bond than ionic than an ionic bond. Much harder to break apart. But just like an ionic bond, it's a chemical bond, so you no longer have hydrogen atoms. You now have a hydrogen molecule. And that's the formal definition of a molecule. A molecule is some number of atoms of nonmetals held together by covalent bonds. Salts are not molecules, right? They are ionic compounds formed by ionic bonds. Notice the important difference, though, here. Each of these two hydrogens is now perfectly satisfied, just like helium. They don't want to have anything to do with any other hydrogen atoms. And therefore, just this exactly two hydrogen atoms together make up one molecule. And a sample of hydrogen gas is going to be made up of individual hydrogen molecules that are not attracted to each other. You see the difference there? Okay, I'll continue next time.